This is Icon Art Radio. I'm here with Alan Cobb, and Donna Colby's back. We got talking about sound, and it was so fascinating, I thought we should talk a little bit on the radio about it.
It was a gigantic drainage tunnel that ran down under the underground and came out on the beach a mile and a half away. And it drained this big canyon rather than allowing it to wash away Sunset Boulevard. So it handled a lot of water. And it was very, very big. And it had a reverberation time that was probably close to a minute or more. And we'd go in there and we'd get these horns going and we'd blow a loud blast on these low horns, which were played like trumpets or tubas, and they were made out of progressively larger sections of plastic sewer pipe. And the sound that they made would take forever to die away to silence again. We also found that if we blew pulsing blasts on the horns and we got the pulses timed right, that they would sync up with the resonance of this huge tube that we were inside, whose fundamental resonance was, of course, incredibly low frequency, like maybe 1 hertz, 1 cycle per second. So you'd go blast, blast, blast on the horn, and these waves would be going up and down the length of that tunnel, and it would build. If you blew your next blast as the echo was hitting you, then it would add and get louder and louder and louder. But it's not loud in the audio sense because you can't really hear it. You're hearing a little of it echoing around, but the fundamental is half of a cycle per second, or 1 cycle per second, which you don't hear at all. But it's still a pressure wave. And what happens is it gets so intense that you actually feel it. And it actually squeezes your body as it goes past you. And it collapses your lungs and it makes you blow. And so once you start to get into the rhythm of the tunnel, you can then keep blowing in that rhythm automatically without even trying to, because it's breathing you. The tunnel is actually breathing you.
Wow.
And it was just a wonderful experience of the other aspects of sound that are not perceived with ears. They're perceived with whatever senses are affected by them. In this case, the whole body was being squeezed by it.
But I think it's remarkable that our attention's not here, that it's so much more visual.
Yeah.
And so just to be talking about it is like opening up another world that we don't think much about.
Because I think if you asked most people if they had to lose one of their senses, either hearing or sight, which would they choose to do without, I would guess that most people would want to keep would think that their sight was the most important one to keep.
Yeah.
But from all that you've been saying today, maybe in real experience, you know, it wouldn't be.
Well, it would be a terrible loss.
It would be a terrible loss,
hearing,
either one.
Yeah.
But
I think, you know, we think that it's like silent, like right now. A person would think it's silent because they're just not aware of all the sound going on at the very moment. But and yet the visual is all very much where we're living.
Well, and the importance of sound, too, in real life is obvious when you realize if you're in a restaurant, let's say, that has bad acoustics, it's not a pleasant experience. Even if it's beautiful in there and the food is delicious, it's not. You don't feel like going back there like you do to a restaurant where the sound is just
especially
more
if they're playing stupid music.
Yeah, or something like that. Whatever. It does.
Well, restaurants today don't have the cushioning draperies and all the carpets and stuff they used to have, so that they're really loud. So I find almost every restaurant to be uncomfortable, but I probably wouldn't notice automatically why I'm so uncomfortable.
Well, that's the thing. People never pick up on the actual cause of their acoustic experience. Acoustics and sound affect you viscerally and subliminally and subconsciously, or however you want to describe it. But it very rarely does someone walk out of a concert saying, boy, the musicians were great, but the acoustics were terrible. It's more likely they're just going to walk out of there saying, I didn't really enjoy it very much. And we deal with that a lot at the Sondheim, where there is a small acoustics problem, and it's enough to interfere with the intelligibility of dialogue and lyrics, but you can't put your finger on why you can't understand it. You figure it's the mics or the guy in the booth isn't adjusting the sound correctly. And even with optimum adjustment and the most experienced person in the booth and the best of body mics and things on stage, the room is messing with the sound in a way that's specifically disadvantageous for dialogue and lyrics.
Well, and that's something that probably many people who make buildings, like architects who design buildings, don't understand, you know, that if I make the room this way and this shape, which is going to look really cool,
yeah,
it's going to bounce the sound, you know, have this particular effect on the sound.
Right.
I would guess that's not, I mean, you would think that would be an essential part of an architect's training, and maybe it is, but
one would hope it would be.
But I would think that in a theater it would be
especially in a theater
definitely approached. But I think that it's a very fine art form.
It is, and it's worthy of note in recognition of some of the architects who have, you know, done a terrible job on the acoustics of theaters. That Lincoln Center, when it was first opened, was an acoustical disaster. Hmm. They got the best architects in the world, and they got the best acousticians consulting on it, and the result of the design was terrible. And it was so terrible that they closed it and remodeled it and fixed it. And that's when I think their hexagonal clouds appeared on the ceiling, which are these panels with variable reflectance and a certain amount of dispersion characteristics, and they're adjustable at different angles. And they were able to change all the acoustical properties of the ceiling with these panels and correct the problems with the room. And then there are other situations, like Lincoln Center has a jazz concert hall now, and the back wall of it is glass. And you couldn't ask for a worse thing to have behind a band than glass. Mm-hmm. It's a perfect mirror for mid-range and high-frequency sound. And as a result of that, they had to go to great extremes with the rest of the room to make the room work, with even though it had this horrendous backdrop for the performers. And it was because they really wanted the visual design of the room to be that way. But the price they paid for it was that without a tremendous amount of very concerted acoustical engineering, the place would never have sounded any good. Mm. And from what I hear, it sounds great now, but it's a unique environment, and they still have to have things, sound-absorbing things, between the musicians directly and the glass wall behind them. It's an amazing thing.
There's probably a constant tension between the architect, who's looking for a visual,
yeah,
in many cases, and the sound people.
Yes, and also between the building budget, the interior decorator, and the sound issues. Mm. I think our own, you know, pavilion in the Civic Center is a great example, because as the building was nearing completion, they were cutting costs and they were trying to keep the cost overruns from getting too terrible. And maybe the architect, I don't know the history of it, maybe the architect had designed an acoustical treatment for that room, but it's hard to imagine that anyone would allow the construction of a room like that without warning the customer that it's going to be very close to useless. Mm. Because it's supposed to be useful, and that's why they're building it, and you don't need, it's nothing subtle about that. And it was just amazing to me to see that gigantic room with hard, smooth, flat surfaces everywhere and nothing to absorb any sound at all. And as a result, it did sound horrible to the point of it being essentially useless until we finally got funding and got around to implementing a remediation. And now it sounds, you know, pretty decent. It could be better. There's now you can hear some of the other acoustical issues with a room that shape. But at least it doesn't drown itself out in the first sound that occurred there, you know, 30 seconds ago. It had a 7.5 second reverberation time. And if you went in there and spoke a word in a normal tone of voice, you could hear that word for a good 5 or 6 seconds. Hmm. And when 2 or 3 people were talking, it meant that there was something reinforcing something during any given second. And I remember on opening night, when the building first opened, there were about 30 people just at one end of the room talking in a normal tone of voice and drinking and cracking jokes and discussing things. And I stood at the other end of the room and made a recording of it. And I used that recording as a recording of bedlam, a recording of chaos. In fact, I used it in the stairway piece that I did at Emerald Gallery, where you start out at street level, and as you go up the stairs, the sounds go from chaos at street level to celestial when you get to the top floor, top steps. And I actually used that recording of the pavilion as part of the background of chaos. It sounded like 100,000 people all talking at once. And
how many people was it actually?
About 30. And talking in a normal tone of voice and 80 feet away from you.
Mm-hmm. So maybe somebody who built that room decided, hey, let's make the sound be exactly like the King's Chamber in the Pyramid at Giza and have a long, you know.
Yeah, I wondered
cool that would be.
It wasn't that far from it. It should be a little longer. The difference in the tonal quality in there and in the Great Pyramid is noticeable, though. Also, and the thing about the Great Pyramid is, it's so dense and so huge out between you in the King's Chamber and the rest of the universe that no sound gets in.
Oh, from that, yeah.
It is absolute silence. The only sound in there is your sound.
What you make, yeah.
And it's not that I've been there. I dare say I'd love to at some point.
Well, I was in a big room in a cave one time that was like that. Going spelunking, where we had to take about an hour of crawling through narrow passages in this cave to get to this big room that the guy knew about. But it was really worth it because you really, it's like your breathing and your heartbeat and was pretty much all you could hear in that room. It was so insulated and it was marvelous.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed it.
Which raises the thought of all those sounds that we make that are not deliberate and are not part of our intention to communicate or express ourselves, and which are all therefore tuned out.
Yeah.
We go out of our way not to hear our own pulse and not to hear our heart beating and not to hear the rustle of our own clothing. Or, you know, sitting in the dome, settling down to meditate, and someone comes in and sits down 15 feet away from you wearing a squeaky nylon parka. And every tiny movement that they make is absolutely unmistakable and too distinct to tune out and make it go away.
It's like if you're in the theater watching and somebody open some, like, their bag to get a mint or something, and it's Velcro.
Yeah.
It's like, that's one of the most annoying sounds to hear in a quiet place when you're, you know, have the ambiance a certain way.
One of the recordings I'm working on, it's called Room Tone, which is what they call the sound of the room in which a shot was just made for a film. You record the room without anybody making any noise so that if you need to fill in some smoothness of the background between shots, you've got some recording of the room without anybody doing anything. And we think of this room as being silent. When we stop talking, we're thinking, oh my, it's dead air on the radio program, and people think their radio station isn't tuned into the channel anymore or something, or KRUU has gone off the air. But it isn't silence at all. And what I found was particularly interesting was to record a series of silent spaces and splice them together with chop cuts, with just, you know, real cuts from one recording to the next without any crossfade or lap dissolve going on, so that you're able to hear this distinct difference between the sound of one room and the sound of another. And there's no way naturally to hear that. You can't go from one room to another quickly enough to hear the sound just switch from one to the other. And I've got a small but growing collection of silent rooms. And if you listen to them, that doesn't work too well on speakers, because there's enough room tone in the room that the speakers are in to mess up the effect. But if you listen to this on headphones, each room, you're in it. You know, you hear this environment and you recognize it's a kind of environment you've been in before. And your whole attention settles into that environment. And then instantly, it's different. And even if it's not different by very much, it's a striking change. And you start thinking about the difference between one room and another in a whole different way, and it's quite surprising how dramatic it is. And of course, this is used in film all the time in a more obvious way. When a scene changes, the traditional approach is that the sound snaps from one scene to the next, and it's that cutting of the sound from one environment to another that tells you it's another scene. It's part of the vocabulary of cinematography. And similarly, you have to prevent that when you make multiple shots for the same scene. There cannot be any sharp cuts from one sound to another, or the audience will read that as a scene change.
And so I might just remind everyone that Alan Cobb is the director of the Icon Sound Institute. And so when we get talking about sound, Alan, he really warms to the subject.
Yes, warm sound.
Well, it is fascinating because it's an area, like you said, it's not an area that most people think about, right, or even, you know, understand very much. And so hearing you explain all of these things, and like in the couple of other shows where you've explained how the sense of hearing is connected to the brain, that's equally fascinating because we don't really think about how that works either, and
right,
and how it really is a big,
well,
feature of our lives.
And I think this is the idea behind the Icon Sound Institute, is to bring it more to the forefront. Mm. And we talk about visual art, but I think of Icon as dealing with how we manipulate the visuals and the sonic to create experiences of beauty and interest. And
yeah,
and I like so much that you've been that component in our arena.
Well, and I mean, for me, my son Dane is a sound artist, mm-hmm, as well, using, yeah, found sounds and all kinds of, yeah, things, and to create his musical compositions and his radio show. And when I listen to his radio show, it always seems like the soundtrack to a movie, even though there aren't any actual visuals.
Right.
Because it has that quality that soundtracks of movies have, with very selected natural sounds, mm-hmm, that he has put together in a certain way, so it gives you the flavor of something. So I'll be listening to his sounds and I will see, literally in my mind, a shadowy figure, you know, just meandering through the dark streets of a city or something like that, even though the sound doesn't specifically have to do with it. There's something about the quality of that sound that says that to me. Or children dancing, even though it's not music and there are no children in it, there's something in the energy of that sound that gives that kind of atmospheric flavor to it.
Yeah.
And I've never been able to figure out with my intellect how that works. If I go back and like analyze now, why did that sound make me see that thing?
Right.
Well,
we're just not that awake in our storehouse of impressions of sound that operate constantly on everything we experience.
Yeah. Well, I think it's partly due to the fact that sound is a crucial omnidirectional warning system for the biology side of our existence. Vision is very important, but it's not omnidirectional. And when you're asleep, it's turned off. But sound is on during sleep, and sound is omnidirectional. And if something starts crunching through the leaves towards you, the brain is set up to detect the difference between crunching and crunching towards you. And it will detect that, and it will wake you up. Hmm. Unless it's a sound that you hear all the time, because you have a dog and you're in a safe place, and the dog is always crunching towards you at different times during the night. But it's a crucial survival mechanism. And, I mean, there are many of them. Every sense has its own set of survival perceptions. We smell rotting food, and it revolts us, and so we don't eat it. And that saves us from being poisoned, and it's very important. And similar, you know, things occur with the other senses, but we're left with this sense that in a sense is on all the time and therefore has to be filtered out most of the time. The things that we're, you know, the foveal portion of the retina is a very small portion in the very center of the retina that is where we have this high resolution visual perception. And if we had to read without a fovea, it would be very difficult. The letters would be kind of blotchy and indistinct, and they'd have to be bigger, quite a lot bigger. But with sound, there's no analog to the fovea. We hear it all. And in the sense that the ears pick up all of it. We can't afford to hear all of it because it's too much. It's too much input. It's like the science fiction concept of the telepath who goes into the town and goes mad because she's hearing everyone's thoughts and there's no room to hear her own anymore. And unless a telepath can somehow close his or her mental ears, he'll go nuts. So I think one of the reasons we have this gap in hearing is because it's necessary for us not to hear everything. Because we're dimly aware of everything, or much of it, not really all of it by any means. But that dim awareness is enough. And if we were to be discriminatively aware of it, as I am sometimes when I've been thinking about this stuff a lot and I've been recording things, I've been listening ferociously on headphones and stuff, then the world is different and I am hearing every little thing. And if I've been working in acoustics and I go into a room, I'm listening to the room as well as the people that are talking. And I can lose track of what they're talking about because I'm listening to the room. And the room is interesting in that context.
What you were saying before about the crunching of the leaves at night when you're sleeping, it reminded me of the difference between being used to hearing city sounds or country sounds.
Yeah.
When you're in one, and I grew up in cities, and you know, here I live in a small town. And one time I spent a week at a retreat center in Kansas where I lived in a little hermitage out in the woods, and I could hardly sleep because the sounds that were outside of the leaves crunching or insects banging against the window and everything were so unfamiliar to me that they were frightening, even though probably nothing frightening was actually going on.
Right.
It was, they were just not my familiar soundtrack.
Right.
Whereas I've talked to other people who've grown up in the country, and they are equally frightened by the sounds in a city.
Right.
Because that's for the same reason.
Yeah, I was lucky because I grew up half and half. And I still very fondly remember the sound of New York City roaring all around in the night. And it wasn't an ominous roar. It was just this sort of indistinct blast of unending energy and activity, with occasional blips of car horns and brake squealings and things like that rising above the general faint din. But it wasn't a din because it was easy to sleep with it. And then we'd go up to upstate New York and I would listen to katydids and things like that and a squirrel or a raccoon jumping out of a tree in the middle of the night is a pretty loud and distinctive noise. Or are raccoons fighting with one another in the middle of the night, which sounds like women being, you know, murdered viciously. Horrendous noise. And the first time you hear it, it's really quite terrifying. And then after a while, you get used to it. And then after a while, the brain filters it out while you're asleep, and it doesn't wake you up when you hear that sound, even though it really does sound like someone being brutally murdered.
How long before you discovered it was raccoons?
Oh, the first time I heard it, and it scared me half to death. I ran crying to my parents, and they said, "Oh, it's just a raccoon, dear. Don't worry about it." But, you know, we condition ourselves that way. Spontaneously, you move into a new place and you're sleeping there and the icebox makes different noises and it wakes you up, and then you learn that they don't matter and so they don't wake you up. The thing that always fascinates me is how a sound can wake me up and I have this tiny window of opportunity to replay the sound that woke me up. And if I don't replay it instantly, then it's a sound that was heard during sleep, and I have no idea what it was. I just know that something woke me up.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.